The Guardian.
Have you always wanted to write a novel, a history, a short story, your epitaph? Want to know how successful authors do it? It's all in a new Guardian book. I'll tell you more at the end of this podcast.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
So, I mean, those people who do venture in are finding that there's scope for some really new and original ideas.
Theoretical physicist and broadcaster extraordinaire, Professor Jim Al-Khalili joins me to discuss how the strange world of quantum mechanics could provide some key insights into the biological world. It could explain how plants harvest light and how birds can see magnetic fields. And...
Well, if you're really smart-ass, then this is useful because what you care more about is how to ask tricky questions so you can fool people.
Just ahead of the annual Ig Nobel Prizes, we bring you an interview with the founding force that is Mark Abrahams. He's here to tell me about a new book celebrating the craziest and most compelling scientific research known to man. And Ian Sample and Robin McKee also join me to discuss this week's science news, including mitochondrial DNA therapy, the strangeness of the placebo effect, and wildcats in danger in Scotland. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Jim Al-Khalili is a professor of physics at the University of Surrey, who's also known for his TV programmes such as Shock and Awe, which charted the discovery of electricity, and his Radio 4 interviews with scientists in The Life Scientific. He's here today to talk about one of his latest scientific research projects, the study of quantum biology. In other words, how the weird world of the tiny affects the behaviour of the messy world of cells and living organisms. Jim, welcome back to the podcast. You're here to talk about something that's grabbed your interest in recent years. Quantum mechanics, obviously, is your field, but biology. Now, these two things don't necessarily go together. One is the study of very tiny, sterile environments in labs, lasers, there's all that sort of stuff. And the other one is the rich tapestry that we see around us. How on earth do these things come together in any coherent way?
Well, I think at a very basic level, it's inevitable that they come together. I mean, it's inconceivable that quantum mechanics doesn't play a role in biology. After all, quantum mechanics underpins physics and chemistry because it tells us how the electrons arrange themselves in atoms and how atoms fit together. And after all, at a fundamental level, biology, down at the level of, you know, beneath the cell, is organic chemistry. So quantum mechanics must be the basis of biology at the fundamental level. But that's not what we mean when we say quantum biology at the moment.
But that's the thing. So at the quantum biology level, there are going to be all these strange effects going on because quantum mechanics is one of the most counterintuitive things out there. And before we go into examples, I think it's worth maybe defining a few of the terms we might be using. So give us a sort of a noddy's guide to some of the quantum effects that biologists might become interested in.
Yeah, so these are not the basic effects like how atoms bond together and how electrons arrange themselves. These are the weirder counterintuitive aspects. So one example is superposition, or what's called quantum coherence. And this is the idea that a quantum entity, an electron or a proton or even a whole atom, can do two or more things at once, or be in two places at once. It's the fuzziness of the quantum world that may actually play a role that we can detect and measure and see in biology. So that's one, superposition and coherence. The other is something called entanglement. Quantum entanglement is well known in physics, in subatomic physics, where you have two or more quantum particles, electrons, photons of light, that are maybe far apart, but their fates are still intertwined. They're still interconnected in some way. So when you do something to one, it remotely affects the other one. Again, not something we see in the classical world. Very strange, but we know it happens down at the quantum level. Quantum tunneling, which is an area I'm particularly interested in, which is the idea that a particle, rather than punching its way through a force field, will sort of disappear on one side and suddenly reappear on the other. It's like kicking a ball up a hill, but not kicking it quite hard enough for it to reach the top of the hill and roll down the other side. But just kicking it weakly, it'll go halfway up the hill, disappear, and pop out the other side by magic. It's another one of these magical things that happens in the quantum world.
When you say magical, it's mathematically true.
It's mathematical. It's so, magical in the sense that it seems so weird. And yet, we are no doubt that this happens all the time.
And you detected it. And in fact, quantum tunneling, for example, is the reason that radioactivity exists.
Quantum tunneling is the reason the sun shines. It's the reason we're here. Because it's the way hydrogen nuclei in the sun confuse together to make helium. Without quantum tunneling, their positive electric charge would mean they always repel each other and never get close enough to stick together.
Now, all these things you've described, all these weird quantum effects, are common to people who maybe study solid state physics and do transistors and electronics. And these things are absolutely used in lots and lots of devices. So in one sense, that makes sense. You know, the way that transistors work and all these other things has their stuff in it. How does it start to approach biological systems? Because biological systems are not as constrained and clean as electronics. They are messy and noisy, and you'd think that all these tiny, tiny effects that you've described would just disappear in that noise.
True. There's something called decoherence. It's the idea that this weird quantum fuzziness leaks away once a system becomes very complex and very large and made up of many billions or trillions of atoms. But the stepping stone between sort of the theoretical physicists that do nuclear particle physics or condensed matter physics and biology are the chemists. There are people called quantum chemists who study organic molecules and how they bond together. And for them, you know, they understand quantum effects are very important in chemistry. And these organic molecules are essentially the stuff that makes up living cells, proteins, enzymes. So these quantum effects are buried deep within these molecular structures.
So let's go through some examples. What kinds of things might be amenable to a sort of quantum physics description? What kinds of life-bearing things?
Okay, well, at the slightly more mundane level is that quantum chemists who apply their techniques, and these are very sophisticated mathematical techniques in biology, are looking at things like how proteins fold, how enzymes, how big molecules dock together and how they fit together, and how whether the way they sort of vibrate has a quantum origin. At a more sort of sexy level, the more sort of counterintuitive level, there are things like photosynthesis. I mean, that's the most probably highly publicized example. The idea that the way a plant gets the energy from the light that falls on the surface of the leaf down to the center that can actually process and use that energy seems like it utilizes quantum mechanics. The quantum idea that a particle that wants to get from A to B doesn't just go in a straight line. It can follow all paths simultaneously and sort of then make up its mind, which is the most efficient way. This is something that Richard Feynman showed.
This is the path integral.
Path integral, yeah.
So you work out every single path between two different points, work out the probabilities, and then that
we do the maths, but what's so amazing is that nature seems to have done this already.
So it does maths in some
nature
way.
Nature does maths. Nature's done quantum mechanics. It's figured out that that using quantum mechanics is the most efficient way of getting this energy down through the biological system. Basically, what's moving are electrons. So electrons in atoms are exciting each other in a cascade all the way down from the surface of a leaf down to the center. And that seems to follow the rules of quantum mechanics.
Okay, and it finds the most efficient way to do that.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily a straight line. I mean, give us some more examples. I've heard that you can try and explain how birds sort of see, in inverted commas, magnetic fields using quantum mechanics.
This is amazing. I mean, and it was a subject of a quite high-profile paper in the journal Nature. The idea that, this is the European robin that migrates from, I think, Scandinavia down to the central plains of Africa every year, and it uses the Earth's magnetic field to navigate. You'd think it would have in its brain some sort of built-in compass, so it could follow the direction of the magnetic field. But instead, what it seems to do is not that. It follows the gradient of the magnetic field, sort of a bit like a sort of a gyroscope. And the way researchers suggest it does this is by using the idea of electron entanglement in atoms within proteins in the retina of the bird's eye. So these electrons can coexist in two states, quantum states at once, and it's that distinction between those two states that is affected by the Earth, the gradient of the Earth's magnetic field.
So what is it doing? It's seeing light that's hit. Well, the light hits the retina of the robin's eye.
No. It's not clear whether it's to do with light hitting the retina. I guess at that level, it's the Earth's magnetic field, an electromagnetic field, the force carrier of the electromagnetic field are photons of light, and those electrons are interacting with those photons. So we're talking down at the sort of the quantum level. It's very speculative, we should say, at this stage.
And again, the robin's not doing any maths at this point.
The robin's not doing any maths. It doesn't quite realise that it's...
the photons and electrons in its body is all doing all this, and it allows it to detect the field. Give us a couple more quick examples before we go on to your specific research area.
Okay, well, it's been suggested that things like the molecules that are responsible for smell in the nose also utilise quantum mechanics. It's also thought that certain molecules in the cells can transfer energy using quantum mechanics. The way enzymes work can be made more efficient using what are called electron transport ideas in quantum mechanics.
Now, where did this idea to put quantum mechanics and biology together, where did it come from? I mean, is it completely new, or were there inklings of this for a while?
It's not new at all. You can probably trace it back to the great Erwin Schrödinger in his book What is Life in the mid-1940s. That inspired Crick and Watson, although they weren't particularly using quantum mechanics. But there's a very fascinating paper from the early 60s by a Swedish physicist called Per Olof Lowden, who is a famous theoretical physicist, where he speculated that quantum tunneling might be a mechanism for mutations in DNA. And in the very first paragraph of that paper, 1963, he talks about this new emerging field of quantum biology. So quantum biology as a field has been around at least half a century.
And so why the sudden interest now? What's become interesting about it? Is it amenable to probing? Is it that just more people are interested and thinking, well, we could use this for something?
Well, it's certainly the case that experimental techniques are becoming more sophisticated and we can do very, very accurate and sensitive experiments. But I think it just simply has gradually become fashionable that quantum physicists have started to realize that there are some interesting effects in biology. You know, biologists are scared of quantum mechanics or, in the worst case, don't even believe. I know biologists who don't believe quantum mechanics. And quantum physicists, on the whole, no way are they going to venture into something as complicated and messy as genetics and microbiology.
Messy, definitely. Complicated, I think they're equally complicated.
Well, physics is much easier than biology, absolutely. I mean, that's very nice and simple. So, I mean, those people who do venture in are finding that there's scope for some really new and original ideas.
So give us a bit of a hint on your own research in this area. And you have an upcoming book at some point in the next year or two, don't you, on this?
Yes. I've been commissioned to write... the definitive book. How horrible.
Well, let's call it the definitive
book. Thank you. You call it.
I'm going to call it. You've been commissioned to write the definitive book on quantum biology. Why don't you tell us what's in it now?
It's essentially it's a popular science book, but it's introducing a lot of these ideas. And of course, in order to write that book, I needed to make sure that I knew enough about the subject. So I'm getting seriously involved in the research. I've got a PhD student working on the subject as well. We've got an international workshop on quantum biology that's running this week. At University of Surrey, my main interest is following up this work on quantum tunneling in DNA. The idea is simple, that the two strands in the double helix of DNA are held together by what are called hydrogen bonds. Basically, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon, these things are held together by a proton, a hydrogen atom that sort of sticks them together. And the hydrogen atom can exist in one of two places, closer to one side or the other side of the strand. So essentially what we think of as a double potential well. So it's sort of, there's a sort of an asymmetry between the two sides. This is known. I mean, this goes back to Crick and Watson. That proton can quantum tunnel. So it can jump from one site across to the other. It's not very likely this will happen. But if it does, just before the two strands separate, in the process of DNA to RNA, when, you know, when it replicates, then you can end up with a mutation. You can end up with a change in the structure of DNA. This was suggested by Loudon half a century ago. Now, of course, we know mutations take place from all sorts of mechanisms. Particles, radiation hitting the cell, just errors in copying. What's never been clarified is whether proton tunneling in hydrogen bond plays an important role. And if it does, how important is this role? So what we're looking at is calculating the likelihood that quantum proton tunneling plays a role in mutations. And I'm working in collaboration with a microbiologist at Surrey, John Joe McFadden, who has suggested a very clever series of experiments to test this idea. So, for instance, you take a simple organism like bacteria, E. coli, and grow them in solution, in water, and they replicate. Well, if you grow them in heavy water, deuterated water, then as they replicate, more and more of their structure will contain deuterium atoms instead of normal isotope of
hydrogen. Heavy hydrogen.
Heavy hydrogen. Deuterated water is heavy water, so the hydrogen in the water molecules there has a nucleus that's made up of a proton and a neutron, what we call a deuteron. It's twice the mass of a proton. Now, as these cells grow in deuterated water, more and more of the structure of their DNA will contain heavy hydrogen in the bonds. Because it's twice as heavy as normal hydrogen, it will be much less likely that it would quantum tunnel. So if quantum tunneling is an important mechanism for mutations, we should see a drop in the rate of mutations when they're grown in deuterated water. And early indications seem to suggest that, yes, that is the case. Of course, what we don't know is how important other mechanisms are and whether other mechanisms responsible for mutation will also be affected by deuterated water, you know, whether it affects the efficiency of the enzymes, for instance. So, I mean, whether or not you get very excited by this is another matter. But the fact is, I can do quantum mechanics. That's why I don't understand the biology so deeply, but I can do the quantum mechanics. So if I find that my tools are useful in another field, that is what I find quite fascinating.
Well, not only useful, but if proved to be correct, they would have to rethink a lot of things in biology too.
I guess so, yes.
How does it feel working in a slightly different field, which is itself, by the way, complicated and you know, a big field, genetics? I mean, do you rub up against geneticists who say, get out of here?
Not yet. I haven't quite sort of immersed myself. I haven't been sort of attending the big sort of biology genetics conferences. It's very daunting because even those, there are physicists who've been working on this stuff longer than I have. And I feel sort of, you know, a bit like this sort of young upstart asking the naive questions because I don't know enough about this stuff. So it is quite scary how much I need to learn in order to make any sort of impact. There are cleverer people who have been working longer in this field who devote more of their time to this, and you think, you know, how the hell am I going to make an impact? But that's the case.
Yeah, they don't know how to solve the wave equation, do they?
Oh, a lot do. I mean, what I'm surprised about is these quantum chemists.
I'm just joking. I'm sure these guys are more than
the quantum chemists are the ones that impress me because they seem to embrace physics and biology and everything in between.
So this is all very well. It kind of gives you a lot of indications about how biological processes might work at these levels, and it's great for the knowledge of that. But are there potentially any applications of this work? I mean, could you use quantum tunneling or other things in biology to create something, make something better, more efficient?
I mean, I don't think people have thought about this very deeply yet, but certainly, in as much as you can control any mechanism once you understand its origins, if quantum tunneling really does play a major role in mutations, for instance, and is more important than the random sort of copying errors that take place, then it means we may have some way of controlling the rate of mutations. I don't think anyone's really explored what this might mean. At the moment, people are still pushing, seeing how far does quantum mechanics go in biology. I mean, there are many people who are, for instance, trying to build quantum computers and realizing that maybe nature's got there first. physicists who are trying to design more efficient solar cells, for instance. You know, if photosynthesis really does use quantum mechanics, then can we somehow copy the tricks that nature seems to have learnt over billions of years in order to create sort of solar cells that generate energy much more efficiently than we can do at the moment? So I think we're a long way off from applications. But nanotechnology is moving very quickly, and nanotechnology is very quickly looking like it's overlapping with microbiology.
I think the idea of using quantum mechanics to make solar cells better is the thing that Ian McEwan's physicist in his last book won the Nobel Prize for, wasn't it?
Or, that's right. Everything I've told you now is just that I got from that book.
Actually, that's true. He predicted all of this, Ian McEwan did. Tell us about your seminar next week. You mentioned earlier you're having a seminar in Surrey over 2 days. You've got some great people coming there, Vlatko Vedral, Paul Davis. What are these guys have been talking about? And you seem excited about it.
It's the first opportunity for me to get together with some of the people who've been working in this field for a while. So Paul Davis has been interested in quantum biology for a few years. Vlatko Vedral at Oxford, you've had him as a guest on your show, has published some of the key papers in this field. And then there are a number of biologists who are carrying out the biological experiments to test these ideas, who are going to tell us where they're at. So I think it's a way of taking stock where things are at now, how closely are the physicists and biologists able to sort of communicate and interweave their ideas. Can physicists suggest experiments? Can biologists suggest ideas that the physicists can go away and check? So it's about not just about where we're at now, but what are the next big challenges in the future?
Jim's Quantum Biology Seminar is on this week at Surrey University. And if you want to watch some of the recordings, they're going to be online at some point in the future, according to Jim. So we'll put links up on our blog as soon as that happens. And now time for some science news. The Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample and the Observer science editor Robin McKee are both here. Welcome to you, gentlemen. Ian, let's start with you. Mitochondrial DNA, there's a consultation that's going to come out this week in looking at what should be legalized and what shouldn't. Tell us what it is and what kind of health benefits the research might lead to.
So basically there are a bunch of diseases which are caused by mutations in mitochondrial DNA. So this is not the DNA that hangs around in the sort of cell nucleus, but the DNA in the mitochondria, these sort of energy making cells, the sort of organelles that sit in the cytoplasm of the cell. Now, these diseases are very varied. They tend to affect bits of the body that require a lot of energy, so the brain, muscles, things like that. But they can be incredibly varied. But they get passed down down the maternal line along with mitochondria. Now, there are a couple of techniques out there which could potentially be used to prevent these diseases being transmitted down the line. You'd have to use them alongside IVF. But at the moment, it's illegal in this country to do those techniques because it involves genetically modifying an embryo or egg, essentially. It's what they call a germline therapy. These mutations, the changes you make, would carry on down the lines, you know, ad infinitum almost.
Which is controversial, but also potentially life-saving for many generations.
Yeah, well, you could look at it in the positive way and say, well, therefore, you've stopped this disease being a problem for these people in the future. And so what the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority, which is the UK sort of health fertility regulator, is doing is it's been asked by the Secretary of Health here to hold this public consultation, which runs through till December, to gather the sort of test the water, gather the public's views on whether this kind of thing is whether we want to change the law to allow this kind of thing if the science becomes gets to the point where it looks really safe to do it.
Okay, so how long will it run for, and what is likely to happen? What's the sort of mood?
So the HFA has already produced a sort of scientific review which looks at the two sort of prime techniques for doing this, and both of them involve a donor. So one of the issues that comes up is that to do this, you get a healthy donor egg from a third party, and you essentially use that healthy mitochondria to replace the faulty mitochondria of the mother, and then you create a sort of an embryo out of that material, and that goes into into that gets implanted into the mother. So you do end up with a genetic material from three people in these children.
And hence headlines of three parent embryos.
Yeah, yeah. And so obviously, you know, you get media terminology creeping in, and lots of people have called these three parent embryos, which is probably, you know, not a great way of explaining them, because parent is probably a bit more than just donating a few genes. There's only, you know, a handful of these things. So people get squeamish about it. People also have all kinds of ethical objections. People wonder, should the donor have some kind of rights to the child? Does it affect the child's future sense of identity? There's all these kind of issues that need to be bandied about. Now, what do the public think of it? We don't know. I mean, who's to say? I mean, and the public is kind of an unhelpful term in a way. I mean, everyone has their own views. And what these guys are going to do at the HFEA is just collate as many views as they can. And obviously, as with any public consultation, it will be hit by a lot of people with strong views either way. But they need to collate them and in some kind of qualitative way present that to the Secretary of State for Health. And then that will feed into a parliamentary discussion as to whether to change the law on this.
Robin, these kinds of discussions about sort of what you call controversial areas of research, there is always that risk that they get hijacked by groups that are looking at it in a very non-scientific way, and or media organizations that have some sort of axe to grind. With this one, there seems to be very careful management of the debate. People are being talked about it a lot, and this consultation is an example of that. Are you confident that we're mature enough now to do these sorts of debates in public?
Yes, I am, actually, oddly enough. I think the stem cell debate that the House of Commons had, gosh, I can't remember how many
years. In the 2000s.
Ago, was an extremely good debate, an extremely intelligent debate. Showed MPs at their very, very best. And we have got some good stem cell legislation out. And it was done in a careful manner in this way. So I would remain hopeful that we can get a sensible set of discussions out of it in the end of the day. It doesn't help when you say you've got three parent families, because it's not true. It's just a tiny scrap of DNA. It's got nothing to do with your nuclear DNA that defines who you are. And, you know, if it helps, obviously if it helps to alleviate suffering, then go ahead with it. But it's best to consult, I suppose, and let people get it off the chest.
I mean, one other thing I wanted to say was that you kind of, it helps to know the scale of this kind of thing. And these, 1 in 200 of us may have mitochondrial mutations. 1 in 200 of us don't have mutations that cause any problems. I mean, the number that have problematic diseases as a result of mitochondrial DNA is small. I mean, you're more like, you know, sort of, well, I don't know the exact numbers, but it's a heck of a lot smaller. And you would probably expect maybe 10, 20, 30 women a year to come forward for this kind of treatment. And it has to run concurrently with IVF. It's not going to be a mass thing here, but because of it is crossing a line that hasn't been crossed before in terms of genetically modifying embryos, it does require, I think, this broader public debate as to whether we want to go down that route.
Robin, let's talk about some Scottish wildcats.
Yeah, Scottish Highland wildcats, the Highland tiger. Well, there's been a report.
Were you going to call it the Highland tiger?
That's how it's projected as. Yes.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, that's how it's marketed.
The tartan tiger, I love it. Yeah. Carry on, sorry.
They are sort of just slightly bigger versions of the moggies we have at home, but pound for pound, probably one of the most vicious animals on the planet. And if you've ever seen a Highland wildcat in a bad temper, woof, it's quite something. They have them at Cairngorm National Park in one of the sanctuaries there. Until recently, it was thought there were several thousand. The most recent survey suggests down to 35 breeding pairs of them out there in the wild. The problem is that they mate with normal moggies, and there are different subspecies, so this actual kind of strain is being slowly obliterated with moggy DNA. Basically, the moggies in our house, is the cats that you have, are of a Middle Eastern, come from the Middle East. Basically, they followed farming, and so they're a slightly different subspecies. And the wild cat, the slightly more bad-tempered version of them, are being isolated increasingly in the wilder parts of Europe, and in Scotland this is now reduced to a few a few dozen pairs around.
35 breeding pairs, that's tragic. Can they do anything at all to reverse that? Or is it something where you just have to manage the decline?
Well, if you look at what happened, the Iberian lynx was down to sort of similar numbers.
Yeah, that was a good story, yeah.
And they have saved that. Yeah. But I've got to say, at the cost of about 30 million quid, that's the kind of money that you have to throw at this project. You have to get rid of the problem of what is causing the problem. And in this case, it's breeding with other cats.
They're not going to kill all the cats, are they?
That's going to be very difficult. How are you going to stop that? I don't know. And then you've also got to find a reintroduction program. You've got to kind of take your animals out in the wild, breed them in cages, and then let them loose. Yes, probably you can do it, but it's going to be extremely expensive.
In my mind, though, I thought these wild cats would be off out in the hills, away from the domestic cats that are in the more urban areas. I mean, there's actually...
That has protected them until recently, but basically these domestic cats have gone feral. And
oh, really? They've gone out into the highlands?
Yes, and basically as townships spread and the urban spread, has it slowly, the cats have sort of by osmosis, have left these areas, and are just sort of, there they are. Sex is a terrible thing for a cat.
It's a feline gentrification of Scotland.
Yes, not Robin, before time. White settlers.
You've written about this in The Observer on Sunday, but what are the chances then? You've outlined the problem. You've got to get rid of the cats somehow, which is difficult, or at least stop them having sex with the wild cats, and you need money. So is any of this going to happen?
What's happened in the case of the Iberian lynx, it's a more distinctive animal, it's got to be said. It doesn't breed with cats. It kills them. Moggy goes near an Iberian lynx, it kills it, because it's about twice the size. But it's been that the Iberian lynx was defined as an Andalusian animal and made the emblem of the region. And so the populace began to identify with it. So when you used public money to save it, they kind of felt it was there. It was their own animal that was being saved. In the case of the Iberian lynx, they were being killed by random trapping, and they had to go around and persuade a lot of landowners to stop trapping. And when they did that, then the cause of the decline was removed. In that case, I'm not saying it was easy, but it was achieved. It's slightly more difficult in this case, it's got to be said.
Ian, let's go on to the final story with you. This is a story about the placebo effect. And the more people research the placebo effect, the more strange and interesting it becomes. So this is kind of an interesting and slightly disturbing development.
Yeah, although maybe not so surprising if you sort of think about it. But this was a study led by Karen Jensen at Harvard Medical School. And when you think about the placebo effect, most of us will think, okay, that's something that will happen if I have a sugar pill or have a sham injection, a saline injection or something. So your body triggers some kind of response to, say, get rid of pain or something, because you've had this very tangible, very visible intervention. Even if it's done nothing, your body still kicks in, you know, with this thing. What her study showed was that things that you are not even conscious of can trigger the placebo effect, and its evil twin, the nocebo effect, where you feel worse because of something done to you.
Measurable worse.
Yes. Yeah. So, and in this case, it was measuring the difference between, do you feel pain a lot or a little? And her study was going through that.
Well, my name is Karen Jensen, and I am a research fellow at Harvard Medical School and at Massachusetts General Hospital.
So you've just published work on placebo and nocebo. Before we get into the details of what your study found, can you just say what placebo and nocebo are?
Sure. Placebo is the beneficial health effects that can be obtained in response to something that is inert. That means a sugar pill or something else that we think is ineffective, but it still elicits a positive health outcome. And nocebo is the opposite of the placebo. It's something that elicits a worsening of our health outcomes, even though it's an inert treatment in itself.
So take us through your study. What did you do, and how does it sort of fit into the context of the work on placebo and nocebo?
Well, in this case, we wanted to investigate whether signals of learned responses could elicit placebo and nocebo effects even though they were presented outside of conscious awareness.
So what does that mean in more sort of straightforward language?
It means we wanted to see if very subtle cues, implicit cues in the context, in the environment around the patient, or in this case, the healthy participant, was able to convey information that would make them respond with a placebo or a nocebo, even though they could not report that they had seen the signal or this cue.
So what kinds of things does your study actually find then?
What we found was that even though our participants were not aware of the signal that was signaling either higher pain or lower pain, they responded with higher pain and lower pain in response to an identical pain stimulus.
So let's get through the methodology a bit, because people probably need to understand a little bit about what you did in the lab with these volunteers, just to get a sense for this. You were showing them faces that they had previously been trained to associate with sort of high or low pain, but maybe take mm-hmm. us through a bit about what you did experimentally.
Well, so first we conditioned them. So we went through a so-called learning sequence when they learned that one picture on a computer screen would always be paired with high pain, and another picture on the computer screen would always be paired with very mild pain. And after that learning sequence, or the association between a picture and pain, we started what we call a test sequence, when we wanted to test how they would respond to an identical pain stimulus. So that is a stimulation that would be exactly in between the high and the low that they felt before. So what we did was showed the same pictures again, but we gave them the moderate pain stimulus for all of them, and we looked at their ratings, and we found indeed that all the participants were rating pain higher when they saw the cue for high pain and lower when they saw the cue for low pain. And we did two different versions, one where the pictures were clearly visible for the participants, and one version where the pictures were shown so quickly that they could not be aware of what the picture had been. And even though they were not aware of which picture they had seen, they responded with higher and lower pain in response to those two cues, respectively.
So the suggestion there being that even though they couldn't tell you which face they had seen, the one associated with higher pain or lower pain, their brain was still doing enough processing subconsciously to trigger the placebo or nocebo effect.
Exactly. So we're probably talking about a very rapid perception of these images that reaches the brain and picks up the information needed to know whether this is going to be high pain or low pain, but it never reaches conscious awareness of which picture they have seen.
So do you think this has or may have some implications for patients at all?
Well, since we were able to demonstrate these effects for something like pain, which is highly related to healthcare, we hope that we are going to find in the future a way of enhancing how healthcare is delivered by making everyone aware of effects like this. So just being aware of these things being in operation while doing an healthcare visit might be helpful in the end, both for the patient and for the clinician to understand what actually is going on.
And what sort of things will we be talking about? Because presumably it depends what sort of experiences each individual patient has had in the past.
Well, that's the tricky part, that we all have our own learning sequences naturally in our own lives. And we have associated our own things with either high pain or low pain. So that's the tricky part. We cannot find one size that fits all here.
And so do you think this is only going to be relevant to things we see? So if I go in and see a GP who have an experience of, he's done, say, good stuff for me in the past, he's made me feel better in the past, do you think it's all only going to be visual, or do you think there's going to be, other stimuli that will be relevant here?
I think that all types of perceptual inputs are going to be very important, and especially those that we normally don't pay much attention to, for example, like smells or something like that. I guess those will pass by unnoticed easily by a lot of people.
And what's interesting about this, I suppose, to some people is that previously, even if it wasn't completely nailed down, a lot of people would associate placebo effect particularly with very tangible interventions like taking a sugar pill, like having an injection, whereas the idea that these non-conscious stimuli may be having an effect as well, and actually a reasonably comparable effect by your study, I think, that seems to be, is that controversial or is that just it never really been looked at?
I don't think it's controversial. I think that many clinicians and many researchers had a feeling that this might be true, but there was just not an experimental design to test it. This is a unique experimental design that can really test for this. I think some people might have thought that placebos were only obtained if there was a clear verbal suggestion, as you said, or an injection or something extremely obvious. But in this case, I think that more people, it's not only us, I think more people have started thinking in terms of more unconscious processes with placebos. It's just that this is a novel way of testing for this that we have been able to perform.
So what are your next steps on this? Are you going to look into it further?
Yes, we're going to see if there are different brain mechanisms that are responsible for the conscious and the non-conscious ways of eliciting these placebo and nocebo responses.
Oh, you need to flesh that out a little bit for me. What sort of things do you mean?
So it is possible that different brain mechanisms are responsible for processing a subconscious cue or signal for low pain or high pain as compared to the case that we normally think of, like the obvious, clearly visible type of placebo response that is elicited through a verbal suggestion or through a shot or something like that.
That was Karen Jensen of Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School on her work on the subliminal impact of the placebo effect. Ian Sample, Robin McKee, thank you both very much indeed.
Thanks. Thank you.
Next week, some of the most obscure and seemingly pointless scientific research from around the world will be celebrated at the Ig Nobel Awards ceremony. Remember, this is for work that makes people laugh and then think. Ig Nobel founder Mark Abraham set up the awards more than two decades ago, and recently he's published a book bringing together some of the best winners and advocates of serious but slightly hilarious science. I spoke to Mark on the phone from New York to discuss some of the book's most profound insights, one of which is this beguiling question: why do people in hot countries wear black clothing?
That's the question that a lot of people outside the hot countries had wondered, because if you live
we're
in a cold place
not in a hot
and you
country
travel
in Britain, trust me, we have no idea.
I live in the U.S. and it's pretty similar in most parts of the country. But if you travel to an extremely hot place by your standards, and you see people wearing black, you wonder what's going on. And people had all kinds of theories about it. Now, before you consider their theories, consider if somebody from another country were to come and study you, Alec, or you who are listening on the radio, and study what color your clothes are, they might come up with some ideas that really are not even in your head. So consider that. Some scientists studied way out in the middle of the desert what happens when you take a guy and you make him sit there for, I believe, a half an hour, wearing first white clothing, and then you do it again, but with black clothing, and then you do it again where he's not wearing any clothes at all, except maybe some little shorts for propriety's sake, even though there's nobody in the middle of the desert to see him, but propriety is propriety. And they measured all kinds of things about how the air was flowing and the temperature close to his body and outside his body. And what they discovered was if you wear loose black clothing, that there are a couple of physics effects that take effect, and the heat is carried away. So you're in general not going to be any hotter wearing black loose clothing than you are wearing white loose clothing. Now, the question that everybody's asking is, why do people wear black clothing? So that piece of science does not tell you at all. And what people are still guessing is, well, you know, it doesn't show the dirt.
Well, this is true. This is true. I mean, and those effects that, so essentially what you learn is that black is no worse than white or anything else.
That's right.
So that's
and
a good
it's more fashionable,
well,
which you knew to begin with.
So also you can wear any color you like. That's a kind of liberating in some ways. All right, let's move on. Now, is it true that a pound of lead sometimes feels heavier than a pound of feathers? And that's, it's a trick question.
Yeah, the way you phrased that was quite tricky indeed. And that's what a study tried to figure out. It depends on what you're holding. It depends on whether the thing is the same, whether the two different things you're comparing are the same shape or not. If you're holding something like a little ball in your hand, that's a very different experience from holding something that weighs exactly the same amount but is in the shape of a long, long rod. One of them is easy to manipulate if you twist your wrist around, and the other is going to be very awkward and will probably feel heavier. So what these people discovered by experiment is if you take some feathers and you take some lead and you distribute them, or you take anything else light and heavy, but you distribute them in a different way and have somebody pick up a box that contains these things that are really different shapes, the person will notice that, hey, there's something different.
And therefore, a pound of lead sometimes can feel heavier, bizarrely.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And it depends really on exactly what question you're being asked. In that sense, it's like a public opinion survey, where if you don't know exactly what question was being asked, you might hear the answer and you might assume some things that are wrong.
See, there's some good advice here for people who want to be a bit smart-ass about things, who want to sort of make sure that when they're asked tricky questions, they've got good evidence to suggest the counterintuitive answers. That this is a good book for that. One more.
Well, if you're really smart-ass, then this is useful because what you care more about is how to ask tricky questions so you can fool people.
Well, here's another tricky question, which we'll wind up with maybe.
No, thanks.
Okay. Well, it's in your book. I'm assuming you know the answer. Is it the people who study ethics and who like ethics, they tend to do more stealing of books. Is that right?
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. There have been a number of tests that people have done just looking to see. One of the things that I write about in here is something done in a library where a lot of the people who use this small library are scholars who study ethics. And looking back over the records of what books are supposed to be in the library and what books are now missing, they've discovered that apparently ethics professors steal a lot of books about ethics.
Well, I don't know where to go from there, to be honest with you. I don't know what to say. What do you say?
Well, what does that tell you? I mean, one thing that suggests to me is whenever I see anything in public said by an ethics person, a professional ethics person, I'm always in the back of my mind going to have the question, gee, what kind of books do you have in your library? And, what are your ethics personally? The ones you act on, not just the ones you describe.
Mark, I mean, these are all fantastic pieces of research. And they're all genuinely interesting scientific ideas. And I suppose we've talked about this before, but what is it you think you want people to take away from this book and this approach to looking at science? And we've talked before about the fact that this is not mocking science in any way. This is a celebration of the wild and wonderful things people are interested in and things we can actually perhaps address. What is the message you want people to take away?
It's two things. First is, if you look at something that you're not interested in, at least you don't expect to be interested in, if you look at the details, you might really be surprised and find something that grabs you. Second thing, which is a little bigger, is if somebody, some authority figure tells you something, says this is important, or if they tell you this is not important, or if they tell you this is good, or they tell you this is bad, it's okay to make your own decision. It's okay for you to look at it, maybe look at a couple of details, and make your own decision about what you think about it.
Thanks to Mark Abrahams. His book, This is Improbable, is out now in all good bookshops. This year's Ig Nobels, by the way, take place at Harvard University on Thursday, the 20th of September. It all kicks off at 7:30 p.m. US East Coast time. That's 12:30 midnight for us here in the UK. You can find a link to the live stream of the awards at improbable.com. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time in text, audio and video at guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
Hi, I'm Simon Hattonstone. I'm a Guardian journalist, and I occasionally write books that are not read by many people. Let me tell you about some of the great advice from those who really know how to do it. Top name authors that you can read in a new Guardian book called Write. It's brilliant. Funny, perverse, bonkers and wise. If it sounds like writing, then I rewrite, says Elmore Leonard. There's Anne Enright for despairing writers. Remember, the first 12 years are the worst. So, don't put off that dream of winning the Booker Prize any longer. Get inspired by our new Guardian book, Write. You can get yours for half price, £6.50, using promo code PODCAST. To order, visit guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Anytime up to the end of October.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.